This is A Story of Sorts, the podcast mostly about bookish stuff. Hello everyone, Karina here. On today's episode, I talk with Leah von Essen about embroidery, the many ways to cope with anxiety, about solo travel, and how to safely read while walking. Have a listen. Leah, welcome to A Story of Sorts.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by knowing who is Leah. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Of course. I'm originally from New Jersey, near the ocean. I now live in Chicago on its south side in Hyde Park. I'm a writer, editor, blogger, big soccer fan, anxious, pansexual, empathetic, hardworking girl, getting by in Chicago. I love to travel. And I have a lovely tortie cat named Miss Nellie Bly. She's a hard-hitting journalist working on her next big story. And that's the short version.
And now I was thinking, do you also have the sea in Chicago?
No, the lake. But it's helped. I mean, when I first came to Chicago, I was like, oh, it's a lake. Like in New Jersey, when I've seen like the ocean, I'm so used to it. I was thinking like this, like one of those like tiny kind of slimy lakes that I'm used to. But Lake Michigan is, the Great Lakes are basically oceans. They're big enough that they have waves, they have tides, you know, they act a lot like the ocean. So I still get a lot of that same sort of, it's not the same, but I get a lot of that same sort of peace from the lake here.
Yeah, because I'm always curious. Like, I grew up also on the sea, like by the sea, not on the sea. I grew up by the sea, and people ask a lot, like, don't you miss it? Because there's always that space that you go when you don't know where else to go, and you just need some time for yourself, but you do have the lake.
Yeah, and I definitely find that there. I miss the ocean for sure, but I am lucky enough to live only like a 15 minutes walk from the lake. And it's one of my favorite parts about my neighborhood is I can walk there easily whenever I really need to. And it's definitely one of the best places to get away and just have time for my thoughts.
And you mentioned your blog, While Reading and Walking, that's the name. How did you come up with the name? Is reading and walking something that you do?
It is, yes.
Really?
I first started the blog in 2015 while I was in college. And at the time, especially, I didn't have that much time for pleasure reading because I was, you know, a literature major. So I was mostly focused on all the stuff I had to read for class. But one of the times, like I've always been very good at finding time to read in sort of the in-between spaces. So on buses, on trains, airplanes is one of the very best places to read. And as a very anxious, overly productive person, I don't like to waste time. So when I was walking to class, it would take like 20 minutes to get to class and I would just read on the way. It was just a really good way to get it done. And I think it started being something that people would laugh and sort of mention like, oh, I saw you across the quad today. I knew it was you because you were walking with a book and like not even looking. And it had been mentioned to me enough that when I started a blog, I knew I wanted to have some variation of the reading and walking.
Any tips on how to do that safely? Because that sounds as someone who tends to be very, you know, not looking where I'm going.
It's definitely partially a skill. You gotta use your peripheral vision very well and look up like for small instances a lot to make sure you still got like a line to go. So it's a lot of being able to pick up your sentence like as like from where you stopped so that you can keep checking. But I mean, my main tips are, I only do it on familiar routes, and that's what I recommend. Or if you like find a park where it's like a path, that I also like read and walk on those. But just, you know, obviously, like the only time I read and walk down sidewalks where cars exist are ones that I know, because, you know, I read and walk to work in the pre-pandemic times, and that's 25 minutes each way. So it's a lot of reading time.
So you continued even after leaving campus.
But the thing is, like that 25 minute walk, I know it so well.
Yeah.
You know, and so you know where to kind of look up to make sure there are no cars coming and double check. And like your feet kind of know instinctively from that, as opposed to like, I don't recommend just like striking out in some random neighborhood and doing it because you will get run over by a car. So either there or like in a park, where it's like a path that's in a circle, and you know, you can kind of like just follow the path, because when you're looking down at the book, you can see the path in front of you. So it's easy then. Just don't get run over by cars. That's my main tip.
That made me think about like maybe a new sport, extreme reading and walking. Like in neighborhoods you don't know.
Oh my God. Yeah. My only real word of warning, other than make sure to do it responsibly and look for cars, is beware uneven sidewalks. That's the the only times I've actually like fallen or kind of hurt myself reading and walking, it was because of a side, like one of those sidewalks where you're walking and then like the next one's like this high and you don't notice. Those will get you. Those will really come for you. That's the only time I've actually fallen while doing it. Cause that's everyone's first question. Like, don't you fall down? Like, don't you get hurt? And that's the only time is a really uneven sidewalk. There was like a hole in it and I got caught and I fell down and like scraped my knee up pretty bad.
And you didn't change to audiobooks, because a lot of people listen to audiobooks, and I speak for myself as well while I'm going to work. Do you like audiobooks?
I'm not big on audiobooks, and it's nothing against audiobooks because I think they're fantastic and I wish I could get into them. But what I find is part of why reading and walking is so great is because I'm a very anxious and a very fidgety person. Like, I bite my nails. I'm trying to stop. I have been trying to stop for like a decade. And I need to have something that I'm paying attention to and something to do with my hands.
Yeah.
Kind of at all times, or my anxiety or the nail biting comes for me.
Yeah.
And so reading and walking is great because it's like I'm holding something and my focus is completely taken up between the book and making sure I don't get run over by cars. But it also makes me not get that fear that never leaves me of not being productive enough, because I'm maximizing this time.
Yeah.
But I think what tends to happen with audiobooks and with podcasts, as hard as I have tried, and I have tried, especially because in Chicago winter, I can't read and walk. Mm-hmm. It's too cold.
Of course.
And so I've really tried with podcasts, but I find I usually space out. No matter how hard I try, at some point I will space out.
Yeah.
So it's just, unfortunately, they haven't helped me enough. I'm still trying though. I still, every winter, go back to podcasts in the hopes that like I'll focus on one, and it's still better than doing nothing. So sometimes I'll listen to the podcast, and then if I tuned out, I'll just replay that episode on the way home. But in terms of like audiobooks and sustaining a narrative, it just,
because
my brain goes away.
It really takes the effort to pay attention to what you're listening and to fight your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is, I have days that it's also more troublesome for me to focus on what I'm listening, because my mind wants to think about something else. So yeah, I imagine that if you're actually reading, you're doing something, you're using your hands as well to hold the book.
And, exactly. Yeah,
never consider that. You're an editor, a writer, and book reviewer. Which of these things do you enjoy the most, and which do you find the most challenging?
Yeah, this one is hard. I don't know if I always enjoy writing so much as it, because honestly, it feels both like breathing in the sense that I have to do it.
Yeah.
And also a lot of times it is very hard work. I do enjoy it, but it does, like, it's something that when I'm writing a book, I feel compelled to write it a lot of the time. And so it's almost like a necessary thing I have to do. It's something similar with reading, and I think reviewing is separate, but I would say probably that writing is still the most enjoyable because it brings so much sense of accomplishment, and it does feel like, you know, letting out a breath when you finally get it on paper properly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say the most challenging is always pretty much editing. It's challenging to edit my own work, honestly, on its own, because once you get it out, it's hard to sort of twist around and make it better in those ways. But also, like, editing other people's work is always difficult, and I really enjoy it in a lot of ways, but it always takes a lot of thought process, because you really have to sort of dig. You got to get at, like, the author's intentions. You got to try to make it as readable as possible and as accessible as possible, while also maintaining whatever the writer was trying to do, because you also don't want to like insult the writer whose work you're editing by just rewriting it. It's always like a lot of tight ropes. I also edit a lot of things with like, important alumni, for example, because I work on an alumni magazine. And so if they send me changes and I don't love how the flow of the article looks, or they added 3,000 words, that's more than anyone's ever added, but you know what I mean, then I have to fix it without like changing anything back, and make them see what I'm trying to do, and that I'm not trying to take back all their changes. So it's a lot of tough tightropes. So I definitely say that's the most challenging.
It's curious because I have a feeling, and maybe this is just from Twitter, that everybody who loves writing on one hand also hates writing. it's like, oh, I love doing this. On the other hand, but I hate it. I hate it so much. And what you just said.
Yeah, and I think people dislike different stages of it depending on the person. I think everyone has a different part where one part feels great and the other part feels like grinding gears. For me, that like first draft is like the easiest part. Like I just get all those ideas, all those characters just get to be on paper, do their thing. Then I fix it up to just make it like what I want it to be. And then the second draft, though, when I have to go back and say, okay, what doesn't make sense? What do you need to research? I'm always sitting there just wanting to tear my hair out. Like, I don't want to do any of this. I just want to leave it alone. And I know I can't because it's, you know, not cohesive here. This doesn't make sense, but I don't want to fix it. And I know other writers who that first draft is like pulling teeth. And then it's the second draft when it starts to actually approach their vision and come together that they really start to like enjoy themselves. And so I think it's just that it's hard. It's hard to make words do what you want. And depending on the writer, it might be different parts of it, but it's always a tough time.
Yeah, because people write, I've noticed that people write very differently. There are people who write the first draft almost as if they are correcting as they are writing. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are like, I write everything makes no sense and then I'll go back to it.
Yep, and I'm definitely the latter.
Yeah, because it sounds also like a lot of work, like you have to write it. But on the other hand, at least it's written, which you probably wouldn't do it any other way.
Yeah, and I'm very character driven as a writer. So I often have, like, I know a lot of people are very focused with like outlines. They plan, they sort of know where the plot is, and then they discover their characters or put in their characters or some mix. And I'm very much like, I have my characters, I know the basics of what will happen to them and where I want them to end up. But the middle is sort of often a mystery. And so a lot of times as I'm writing it, it's very like, oh, of course you're going to do this. And, you know, it's almost like the character's doing it and I'm just writing it down. And so I think that's why the first one's easy, because it's like, okay, I know these characters and this is what they're going to do. And now they're arguing with this person and now they're doing that kind of vibe. And then the second part is the outline I didn't do. And imposing it onto like all those things that they want and did, and like trying to figure out, okay, now how do I make it like an actual plot that works and isn't just happening?
What about book reviewing? Because that is so difficult. I find I have like an Instagram account. I always try to review enough so that I will give people the feeling that I got with the book, especially if I really like it. I'm terrible at it. Like, do you have any tips, or what is the secret to a good book review?
I think, and I've been thinking about this one a lot recently because of a very terrible review I saw of a book that I thought was great, where the reviewer just completely missed the point of the book. And I think the number one thing is just to always meet the book where it is first. I think people are like, well, it's my opinion, so I'm just going to give it. And if the book's not my thing, I'll just say, oh, the book's not my thing, it's bad. And the difference is to just meeting the book where it is, I think, as reviewers, is the part where you're like, okay, this was trying to be a cozy romance. Did it do it well? Did it work? Did it not work? And you can say at the end, I don't think it worked because X, Y, and Z. Also, it's just not my thing. What gets me is that there are so many reviews by people who will say things like, this was a romance and I guess the two characters were supposed to end up together, but I don't know. I just don't like happy endings that are cheesy. And I'm like, okay, it's a cozy romance. Like, what were you expecting? And so I think the first thing, and I think the thing that establishes credibility as reviewers, as opposed to just, you know, a person sending out your thoughts on the internet, is that, is meeting the book where it was and then saying you, and you can still hate it, but just making sure it's there. Similarly, like I've seen too many reviews where like, it's like an adult reading a young adult or middle grade book and saying things like, oh, they're so like immature, stubborn, silly, irrational. And I'm like, have you met a teenager? Of course they are.
It's young adults.
And it's things like that. Other than that, I think it's honestly just my main things are be honest, be fair, and never be mean. And I think your reviews will always be fine. I think that's kind of the key. Like being honest, if you hated it, you can say you hated it. The being fair part is the part where you like things like the romance thing, the why, making sure that you're being like being, reminding yourself that there's an author out there who's a real person, and that if you're going to go after something, make sure it's because it's like problematic or something like that, and not just because you didn't like it as a person. And then the never mean part is never making it too much. Like, you know, I've written reviews where at the end of the book, I put it down and I'm like, okay, that was bad. That did not come together at all. That was terrible. And that's the words I'll say to myself. But like, that doesn't need to be how I say it in my review. I can end my review, I don't recommend reading this book. Mm-hmm. It wasn't great. It had problems. But you don't have to sign in and say, I thought this book was bad. I thought the main character didn't make sense. I thought this. Not being mean part just requires a little more work a lot of the times, because you got to instead say like the main character's, you know, narrative arc didn't really work because they said this at the beginning and then they did something completely different and there was no reason. And you're saying the same thing, but that's the not being mean part.
I kind of wonder, for example, you are talking about the situation in which, for example, someone doesn't like science fiction and then they give the book 2 stars and they said, oh, I didn't like this book because I don't like science fiction. Mm-hmm. And that is super unfair because you are reviewing your vision of the book rather than the book itself. Do you get to read a lot of books from a genre that you don't like a lot or not really?
Sometimes, yeah, I have to review or just get to review like a mystery or a thriller, and they're just not books I read as often. Mm-hmm. And so it's harder sometimes for me to judge some of the things. I think too, like some readers, especially readers who have taken a lot of close reading classes, you'll read a mystery or like a thriller and like, you know, a couple chapters in, you're like, okay, well, if this follows narrative sense, then it's like the ant. And then at the end, you know, but like, I think that's all tangled up in that fair aspect. Like you were saying, I think it's really making sure you're being fair and not just saying things to say them. I mean, for example, I review for Booklist and we have to choose a lot of times whether or not to write a review. And if you don't, like, you can say, I don't recommend a book for review for these reasons. And there have been one or two books where I've told my editor, I don't recommend this book, but you might want to try it with someone else. Like, you might want to give it to a different reviewer because I honestly am not fully sure that it's just not that it's not my thing, or that, you know, X trope, I just can't personally, like, I'm not into it and I can't deal with it once it's been introduced, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's that aspect. And I think every once in a while, I've either thought really hard or just not reviewed on my blog a book. If I sit there for a while and I'm like, it might just be me. And a lot of times I manage to work that into the text of the review and be like, this might just be me. But like, if I'm really sitting there, like, I genuinely think there are people out there who are going to love this book, but I hate it for X reason, then every once in a while, I just won't post it because I'm like, this I don't know. I can't guarantee that this is a fair review. Mm-hmm. And that makes me uncomfortable.
Fair enough, of course. What about your other hobbies besides books?
So I have gotten very much into embroidery. That's probably one of my main side hobbies. I've been taking a break from it because as soon as it starts to feel like a lot of work, I was like, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to make another one of my hobbies an obsession that I feel like I must do. So I'm taking a small break from it. But embroidery, what else do I do in my spare time? I play cozy video games. I bake. I am a huge women's soccer fan, so I'm a season ticket holder for the Chicago Red Stars, which is our local team. Very excited about the upcoming season. Mm-hmm. So I spend a fair amount of time with that. And I journal and collage in my journal as well. I guess I would say those are my hobbies.
Did you, with embroidery, because I was very excited when I was talking to you about an interview and you said, oh, I really like embroidery, because I even created like an Instagram account for my embroidery, even though now I haven't been embroidering in more than a year. But
it happens.
Do you feel the pressure to monetize it, for example? Because like I'm always using, of course, I'm spending money buying stuff to embroider. The first thing on my mind, and maybe this is because I'm a Capricorn, I don't know, is how can I make money out of this so that I don't feel that I'm just wasting time and money on it?
Yes. yes, I do. And I think this is actually a book I can recommend. It's called Can't Even by Anne Helen Peterson. And it's about millennials and burnout. And one of the things she talks about is that drive and need to monetize everything, to prove, not just to monetize, but it's to prove that there's a reason for us doing anything, because we've been taught that all time is valuable and mm-hmm. all time is time you could be using to be productive mm-hmm. and to be hustling and to be like making something happen with it. We've been taught that like, you can't just be an embroiderer. You have to be an amazing embroiderer with thousands of followers on Instagram, or it's not worth doing. Mm-hmm. And I think I really connected to that book. There were a lot of explanations for very varied ideas in me about productivity and various anxieties. And I think it's very true. I think a lot of our generation feels that pressure. Like if you're doing something, if you're traveling, if you're doing this, it's like, okay, well, you should make an Instagram and be an influencer. And you can't just be doing it for funsies. You want to be pursuing followers and getting those hashtags right. Well, is there a way you could write for a travel place? And it's hard because I feel that all the time, both with my traveling, with my embroidery, various other things. There's a temptation to be like, oh, well, I should be writing travel pieces then. Yeah. I should be using this in this way or in that way. And I think I've been trying to guard my embroidery from that, partially just because I don't have the time. to monetize another hobby. You know, you can only really do so many side hustles. If it's supposed to be a refuge in mental health terms, it's hard. Once if you start attaching money and productivity to it, it's going to start just being another source of stress. So I've guarded embroidery kind of carefully from that.
Because especially with clients and stuff, like when you start changing things because someone asked you about, and then you get the stress because it's not exactly what they wanted, and you're taking all this time that you're not even going to get paid for.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So completely understand. Well, your embroidery account is called Leah's Cozy Embroidery. Mm-hmm. And how did you and when did you start embroidering?
I started near the end of 2019, I had been interested in embroidering for a while, kind of curious about it. And then I was trying to think of cheap Christmas presents that I could make my friends and family because the budget was tight. And I was trying to think of things and I was like, you know, embroidery is lovely. There's so many good ones out there. And especially for one of my friends. Now I look at this piece and I'm like, wow, I really should remake it. Because it was like my second embroidery piece ever, but I did like one pattern and then was like, okay, now I'm gonna do my own thing. And I'm still very proud of the waves. I made it It was for my friend who wrote a book coming out in October, The Book of Mac, and it's about Mac Miller, and she wrote about him for a year after he died. And I used her favorite lyric from one of his songs, and which is from the album Swimming. And so I did like an ocean, which then had like the lyric over it. I'm still very proud of the ocean. It's the words that I wish I could redo because letters are hard.
Yes.
But I started there, and I later created Leah's Cozy Embroidery, honestly, more just because I send out a lot of my embroideries to friends. Like, I make them a lot for people because there are only so much space on my walls and I don't know what else to do with them. So I send them out to people. So I kind of wanted to have like a place where I could just easily go and see them all just like in a row. Or if people were asking about it, like friends, I could just be like, see, here they all are. And they were easily findable rather than like, you know, pursuing followers or trying to really be an artist account, even though it was tempting. Like I said, there was definitely a temptation near the beginning as I discovered I was good at it. There was a temptation to be like, maybe I should take commissions. Maybe I should, you know, and I took one or two commissions just from like friends. And I think it's a good way sometimes to balance out that fear, which is I said, okay, I'll make whatever you want in my skills. What do you want? And then send me like $20 for materials and shipping. And so that was easy. And I probably still spent more than I got. So, but it was like a way to help balance that out. I think the embroidery really caught on when I returned from Spain and the pandemic sort of began. I had made a bunch of Christmas presents and then kind of put all my stuff away. And when I came back, I was like, okay, I need things to fill up this time. And so I ordered a bunch more materials and had an idea and started with like a piece that was like the oranges that I saw in Seville in Spain. And I made it for my mom for Mother's Day. And then I just kind of kept coming up with ideas. And so that's when I really feel like it became a hobby.
Would you mind sharing those photos with me? Then I can put them on the Instagram post afterwards, like when it gets out, when the post is out, I can add them to the post so people can see them.
Yes, I will send them and I will show you the pieces I'm talking about now over my little camera.
Because I did check your account, but of course I don't know it by heart.
Yes, of course. So this was the first one I did.
Oh, all the blurring. Yeah, but that's really good.
Oh, okay, one second. I'm gonna stop the blur.
You have such a nice background.
Thanks.
Oh, that's super sweet. That's a lot of stitches. Like that ocean is...
Yeah, it took a really long time.
The whole, yeah, that's a lot of stitches.
And then this was the other one I made for someone for Christmas.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Thanks.
Deep breaths. Wow.
Yeah, he has a cherry blossom tattoo. So I did that. And this was the first one of my pieces that had the tiny little bee that I now put into basically all of my pieces.
Oh, okay.
Because I love him.
So it became kind of like your brand.
Yeah, because he's ridiculous and tiny and small and I love him. And these are the oranges I did.
Another one, there's lots of stitches. Oh my God. Yeah. With all the leaves and everything. I will definitely share them.
But yeah, so those are the three.
Yeah, because I do have a feeling that things where you fill in the color, and that's always where you kind of think, do I do this? Do I fill in color or do I just do it like black and white? Because filling in the color is so much work. And if the stitches don't work properly, it just ruins everything.
They totally are. But I think that's the part that I love the most. Like, I love just like filling in giant swaths of color. I really enjoy the sort of color theory of mixing threads and like for oceans and for skies and things. Like, I'll do like one orange thread, one red, and like one yellow, and like mix them up and then stitch with all of them, and it creates like those cool gradients. And that's the part I feel like that really got me to keep going. And the rest, like the words and the pretty way of doing flowers and like all of that came later as I like learned how to do things properly.
Did you go immediately into the stitching without having an idea or without watching tutorials, or did you search tutorials first?
I searched some tutorials and I did like a pattern that taught you a bunch of the basic stitches. And then, but for this ocean one, I did just kind of dive in to some degree. Because I think like I was thinking about this piece, and then once I discovered that for most of embroidery, you sort of separate the threads. My immediate thought was like, okay, but if you separate it into, like if you separate out two threads, what if you then took two threads from another color and just like smacked them together, then you got a prettier color. And then I just started doing it for that ocean. I probably would have benefited with a couple more tutorials. After that, I looked at a lot of more tutorials, but I kind of did them like as I needed to know them to some degree. Like I did like 5 tutorials on French knots, but right before that, cherry blossom tree, and things like that. And then I started later on in like once last spring when I really started getting deeper into it. That's when I started watching more like, and how do I do these cool flowers I keep seeing? And how could I do like oranges? How could I do like this kind of flower? So that's when I got deeper in.
You told me that embroidery helps you with anxiety. Do you want to go into it?
Yes. I think going back to how my anxiety, there's a lot of that drive to always be being productive and to always doing something with my hands. And especially early in the pandemic when everything was anxiety all the time, I think it was really great because it was productive and it was creative. But at the time I couldn't, like I didn't have enough mind power to write. A lot of people didn't. That was too, like it was, we were too distracted. And I think this was great because it made me feel less bad about that because I was doing something actively creative. I was filling that sort of space in my mind that needed to be doing something creative. But once you sketched it out on the cloth, the actual like mind burden of it was kind of gone. After that, you just like gotta keep stitching in the same spot and just kind of going. So that part made it so that I could feel very productive, but also very, I could tune out and just kind of keep stitching, or I could put on Parks and Rec reruns for like the 5th time and just stitch while I watched, you know, or especially early on when I was still really struggling with anxiety of everything going on, I would like embroider during like work meetings because I could, because it was productive and it was something to do with my hands that wasn't biting my nails, but it was also not distracting because, you know, it was just like, if I would do is like, I would say, okay, I'll do this. I'll fill in this one spot today. And all that really took is taking that the right color thread and just going throughout the meeting. And so I think it really just helped my anxiety because it's a, just a great combination of productive without taking up too much space in your head.
And do you have any words of advice or encouragement for people who suffer from anxiety?
Yeah, the first one is just that your problem is real. I think people really struggle with that for good reason because of the stigma our society has against it. And that I think the internal thoughts that people have about it. I know early on at one point when I said, like, I need to get therapy for anxiety, it's time. Someone very close to me was like, yeah, stress management is really important for everyone. And I was like, but that's not what this is. So one of the things that actually helped me a lot very early on is I made it clear to the people close to me that I'm going to use the words anxious and stressed completely separately. Mm-hmm. So my boyfriend now knows, you know, if I say I'm stressed versus I'm anxious, the stress is something we can do something about. The anxious is just something happening to me today. It's just, it's like having a cold. It's just going to be where I'm at. I think that really helped me to separate them out very strictly and to make it so that, you know, because I think like, I mean, I've been told I'm very calm in a crisis. And I'm good. As soon as you give me a problem, I'm very good with stress. I can tackle any stressful situation pretty well. Anxiety is its own thing. It comes out of nowhere. It's chemical. I can't tell when it's going to come for me or why. Some like the other day, it was after dinner and my boyfriend was like, what's up? And I was like, I guess I'm anxious. And he was like, why? I was like, I don't know. you know, and it just arrives. I mean, don't be afraid to treat your anxiety as what it is, which is an illness, which will come and go. And you don't necessarily have control over when. All you can do is deal with it when it's there. Go to therapy if you can, take a sick day if you can. Don't feel shamed about any of those things. They're all good. It's an illness. It helps. It's necessary. And I guess my only other one is if your sleep is messed up, try to get help for your sleep because they are so tied up. And either way, like at least mention it to your therapist if you're going. I know that I didn't mention my sleep to my therapist for like several years because when I was very young, I told my pediatrician that I had insomnia and he said it was because I was so young and active and hyper. And then I became a teenager and he said it was because of hormones and puberty. And so I shrugged and said, okay, no one's ever going to help me with this ever. I guess I just don't sleep like people. To the point where even when I knew insomnia was a real issue, I didn't mention it to my therapist for like 3 years. And then we were talking about it. And like, I talked about how I didn't sleep like at the time, but one day I was like, yeah, I mean, it's like when I didn't sleep in like sixth grade. And she's like, wait, you had insomnia in sixth grade? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, you haven't mentioned this before. I'm sending you to a sleep specialist. And I was like, wait, why? And she was like, because you've had insomnia for like, this is no longer like a little issue.
Yeah.
So I would say like, you know, be honest about your sleep, get help for it. Don't listen to people who are like, just take melatonin or do yoga or, you know,
meditation.
Or take deep breaths. Because those are people who have had insomnia like nights, not insomnia.
But there's also, I guess, situational insomnia, in which you don't sleep because there's one situation in your life that doesn't help you sleep, and those things can help with that, but not if it's chronic.
Exactly. And so if you have chronic really bad problems with sleep, same thing as I said with anxiety, like treat it as such. Don't be afraid to go get help and seek help for it, because it really does make such a huge difference. I'm on antidepressants now and they helped my sleep. And I also saw a sleep specialist who told me a lot of the reasons my sleep was messed up and helped me get better. And it's like topical because like my body doesn't want to sleep at the right time. But that with antidepressants, I can actually like go to sleep now. And you know, you don't realize how much of your life is defined by not getting sleep until you're actually getting sleep.
Yeah.
Like a normal person does.
And then you have more energy during the day.
Yeah. I mean, this is a slight digression in some ways, but when I was in high school, when I was in like sort of college, I like sort of transition from being an extrovert into more of an introvert. And I thought it was just, you know, people grow up. I made friends with a bunch of introverts, you know? So I was like, okay, like I'm more of like an ambivert now. I'm in the middle. Like I took my little, like the Myers-Briggs and like my extrovert score like plunged, right? And then I got treated for anxiety and depression with antidepressants. And within months, I realized I was chattier, louder, like I was being chattier, I was being louder, I was seeking out people more. And it was kind of like a blow that I realized, like, I mean, I was still became more introverted, but a large part of it was just that I was exhausted and anxious. And I think we don't always realize how big something is having an impact on our lives until it's helped, until you're actually getting help. So,
wow. Never really considered it in that sense, that obviously if you have more energy in general, you're going to have more energy to be with people, even if you do need to rest afterwards. Yep. Obviously. Going back to your hobbies and to solo travel, because this is something that you really like to do. Can you tell us about a favorite journey you've made all by yourself?
Oh gosh, yes. There have been so many, but I think one of my favorites was really going to Mexico City. And one of the reasons is because people were very biased and nervous about me going to Mexico City, some of which were...
Oh, so in the States, sorry, I kind of like your friends and stuff, I kind of thought like when you got there, I was a bit...
Oh, no.
I was a bit surprised.
Yeah. So like, you know, there were family members who were like, you're going to Mexico City alone, like appalled. Even though like my dad and I looked at the crime rates between Mexico City and Chicago, not that, you know, not that far off, just different crimes mainly. Yeah. And so it's just like, you know, I was being safe. I had taken a certain number of precautions, but that nervous energy still infected me in other ways.
Of course.
And it wasn't that I was afraid of Mexico City, because that I rejected. Like, I almost became like too confident, because I was like, get away from me. I'm going to be fine. Like, no one, I'm not going to, you know, things happen to people everywhere, but I'm going to be smart enough that I'm at least not going to be like alone in the middle of a park at night, you know? But I felt like the first day I felt an immense pressure to have the best time, because all of these people had made it seem like I would not have a good time. And so like, I felt like there was like a weight to enjoy myself. Yeah. And it took me a couple hours. Like, I was rushing from tourist location to tourist location the first day, like kind of stressed, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And then I finally sat down for like a mojito at the sunset and started reading. And I was like, oh, that's why. Cause I wasn't having fun, because I was putting pressure on myself to prove to these people who were like, are you sure you want to go alone, that I was going to have fun alone. After that, I was like, I'm just going to have fun for the rest of this weekend, and it's going to be great. And I had such a good time. And not only did I have such a good time, but I also made a lot of friends, and the people there were so nice. Like, there were people, you know, like at one point it was winter in Mexico City, but like I was coming from Chicago. So it was like, it was like 10 here Fahrenheit, and I went to Mexico City and it was like 60 Fahrenheit, and everyone was walking around in winter coats. So I was walking around, in my like little summer dress. And like, this woman came up to me on the train and was like, are you cold?
Yeah.
And she was so concerned. And I was like, no, I'm good, thank you. But like, people there were just very, very kind. And like, people would find out I was a tourist, especially like traveling alone, and they would go out of their way to help me and to find, you know, tell me the best spots. And I found like, I met people at the Frida Kahlo Museum, which also the Frida Kahlo Museum was incredible. And I met people, I went to like an Airbnb experience, and that was like to go see Lucha Libre and to go to like a restaurant with some really good food. The food was amazing. They had like a dozen different kinds of habanero salsas, and every single one was amazing. And they all burned my mouth pretty bad, but they were fantastic. And those people from like that Lucha Libre thing, like brought me to a bar afterwards, and we had like a good time. And I still even remember like there were men who were sort of lurking around us a little, but even then, like, they were so much more polite than I expected. Weirdly, it was like, I noticed a couple, like a bunch of men hit on me in Mexico City, but I never felt uncomfortable because they were so blunt about it.
Wow. That... So you knew it immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they didn't try to sneak around. They were very like, I think you're beautiful, go out with me. And I was like, no, thanks. And they were like, okay, beautiful, and walked away. And I was like, cool. Not to say that there aren't creeps there, I'm sure, but it was much easier to deal with. And similarly, like, there were guys sort of lurking around us at the bar, but they weren't really bothering us. And I just remember I was like, okay, I'm gonna head out. It was so nice to hang out with you guys, but you know, it's very late and I have a plane to back to the US tomorrow. And every single one of the like men lurking around us was like, do you need, like, you're getting an Uber, right? Like, and she's going to have your phone number and you're going to text her when you get home, right? Like, immediately they like mobilize. And I was like, yes, I'm good, thank you. She knows, I'll let her know when I get safe. But like, people were just very kind there, and it made it really... And opening myself up to enjoying myself made it so that I really had a great time. The food was amazing. I climbed the pyramids at the ruins outside of the city, and that was incredible. And it was just very, very cool. So I think that was my favorite, I think, because my favorite part about solo travel is that being alone makes it so that you're able to really meet people very easily. And you're open to meeting people, and they can see that you're open to meeting people, because people, especially in cities where it's less common, are like, are you alone? You know, like, why are you alone? Kind of thing. And so I've been adopted by a lot of different travel people over my solo travel times. And it's always the best part.
Especially, do you stay at hostels a lot? Or do you go more like to hotels? Because hostels are so amazing to meet people. Like, you have hostels, all kinds of people there.
I've never ended up staying at a hostel. I've done a lot of Airbnbs where I stay with a host person.
Okay.
And it's nothing against the hostels. It's mostly just because I'm very fiercely independent as a traveler. And so I like being adopted in the sense that I like talking to people. I like being sort of integrated into a group when I happen to be taking the same hike as them. But I hate the sort of pressure of, well, we're all, like, a bunch of us are going tomorrow. You're going to come, right? I'm like, no. Or like I don't. And so, like, the hostel, like, environment is so great for meeting people. But the flip side is that it's, like, also encourages a lot of, like, going with people.
Yeah.
I know you don't have to. I know there's not actually that much pressure. But that's why I like staying alone places, too.
Yeah.
But it's been wonderful. And when I have stayed in Airbnbs with, like, hosts and stuff, they've been amazing. Some of these people have been so nice. I can't even. Like, some of them have made me breakfast. They've, like, and I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, I would wake up and they'd be like, how do you want your eggs? I'd be like, you're making me food. And so some of them have been really lovely.
So I'm going to talk about another experience that you had that was, I think, quite different from the one you just mentioned, which was when you went to Spain. You were traveling to Spain and you had to return urgently to the US because the pandemic news suddenly became very grim last year in March, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And how was that experience? What happened exactly?
Yeah, it was incredibly stressful. I had been having a great time in Spain, and I think it also shows, I mean, it shows partially how bad it was, that how so many governments downplayed COVID, because I was like, I'm going to go. I'll be very safe. I'll be careful. But this was before most governments had been like, you need to wear a mask. You need to not travel, like, you know, as like an explicit no.
Yeah. This is not the flu. Because everybody was kind of like, oh, it's a little bit like the flu.
Yeah. And so I was still thinking of it as like a bad flu.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I was still like, okay, well, I'll go. I'll be extremely careful. And, you know, if I get sick, hopefully I won't. But if I do, at least I'll write down resources so that I'm safe. You know, like I was thinking, like, I had not taken it seriously enough. I took it more seriously than some of the travelers I met, to be fair. Like, I was washing my hands more and I had Purell with me, things like that. But still. And I had basically the same as everything I've talked to you at first. So I had an amazing week in Barcelona. I met so many nice people. I met a lot of great friends. I went to an FC Barca game. I had so much paella, so much wine. And then I went to Seville, fell in love with Seville, watched flamenco both nights. And on my second night in Seville, I stayed up late, had another beer, was journaling, was like, okay, tomorrow I leave for my next location. Amazing, little tipsy, didn't go to sleep until like 1. I wake up at 3 a.m. to my phone just blowing up, because that would have made it like 9 p.m. in the U.S. And my main thing was that my dad had been tracking. He's a big stats guy. So he reads a lot of news. He watches a lot of stats, and he had been tracking the situation. And like early on in my trip, I had had like a panic, like, this seems like it's getting more serious. And I was like, I think I'm going to skip Madrid. My last spot was going to be Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, tomorrow when I wake up, like this night when I went to sleep, I was going to look into like a place I could stay in the south of Spain instead of ending my trip in Madrid, because mm-hmm. Madrid was like the main place in Spain where cases were actually like really skyrocketing at the time. And so I was like, I just won't go there and then I'll be good. I'll sure. be fine. And so, but my dad, when I told him that, he said, you know, I want you to enjoy your trip, but also know that you're okay. So I'll read all this news and I'll let you know if it breaks, like if it breaks through, if it catches yeah. like the point. So stop looking at the numbers in Spain and I'll let you know if it's time. And so the first text I saw when I woke up was my dad saying, like calling me by my nickname in the family, which is Yaya. And he was like, Yaya, it's time to come home. And wow. that's, and so I knew immediately, like, this isn't, you know, someone in my family just like having like what I was having, like a little like panic attack. It was like, it was time, really? Like something had happened. And so I had to wake up on like 2 hours of sleep. And we had to figure out how to get me on a flight. And of course, everyone in Europe who comes from the US was doing the same thing. And basically what had happened is Trump had said, okay, we're gonna close the border to anyone coming from Europe and they have to be back Friday. This was Wednesday night in the US wow. that he said this. He later clarified that one, he meant 11:59 Friday, not 12 a.m., like, so like Thursday into Friday, which mm-hmm. is what everyone thought he meant, which is why my family panicked immediately.
Yeah, you got one day, basically.
Yeah. And we thought that if I didn't get to the U.S. in 24 hours, I wasn't going to get back.
Yeah.
And then secondly, he clarified like an entire next day that American citizens would be able to enter the country.
Oh, just a little detail. I mean,
little
tiny.
Meanwhile, every American in Europe was panicking. And so everyone was trying to get a flight at the same time. We were extraordinarily lucky because my mom was working at a company that had a travel agent because she had to fly from New Jersey to Chicago, actually back and forth. And mm-hmm. so that travel agent was able to then help us find flights, which was amazing because wow. we could not find flights yeah. basically. And so on 2 hours of sleep, luckily I was almost packed because I was supposed to leave that city in the morning, but I had to repack because I was packed for a train trip, not an international flight. So it was like, okay, all my liquids. And I like flat left some of my liquids because I was like, I don't know where to put them, things like that. And I had to go to the airport like immediately and I was so tired. The Seville airport was packed. It was miserable because everyone was freaking out. I managed to get on this tiny little plane in a middle seat, got to the Madrid airport, which I found ironic because I was like, this is the place I was trying to avoid. And now every American in Spain is in the Madrid airport. And yeah. so I was like, that was when I was like, I'm going to get COVID. Like I fully at that point was like, okay, so it's a matter of time because there weren't available masks.
No, of course.
And so I'm walking around maskless with every American who's been in Madrid, and Madrid was having a huge COVID surge. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay,
that's so, it.
That's that. And meanwhile, I get on like the plane that's from Madrid to London, and I'm with like two students who were fleeing Madrid because their programs had been canceled and they'd been told to get on a plane immediately from their study abroad program that had just started. And I'm between them on this plane. And I'm like, so where are you guys going? And one of them was going to like New England and one of them was going to California. And I was like, great. So all three of us are flying from Madrid to various places in America.
Yeah.
This was, and I was like, I don't want to get trapped in Europe, but also this was a terrible plan from our government.
Everybody.
Because we're all, like, if COVID is so that bad in Europe, we're all bringing it back and scattering. But and so then I was in London and then I managed to get on my plane on the way home. And I was up. So I was awake. I had 2 hours of sleep and then I was awake for the next, I think like 24 hours.
Wow. Yeah.
And so I was very, very, very tired. And then meanwhile, everything was a mess on every air flight, because also the flight attendants were like, they, you know, there were lines in security down like and around airports because no one was ready. Like none of these, Madrid airport wasn't ready to suddenly accommodate like 500 new passengers that when they thought they were going to have half empty flights. And so everything was a nightmare too. And like every worst day at the airport, that was this, except now you knew that you were going home to flee from a rapidly spreading illness. So everyone's tensions were high. So it was a lot. And then I think too, it was very hard because this had been my dream trip. And like the other two trips I had, my other solo trips in a lot of ways were all building to this trip because I knew I'd wanted to go to Spain and that was my dream trip, but I didn't want to do it before I knew that I loved solo traveling, which I did. And so this was really my dream trip and it would cut in half. And that was very hard. And then I realized somewhere at the Seville airport at like 6 a.m. as the sun was rising that I was also going to have to quarantine. So I was cutting my dream trip in half, going home, and then not going to be able to see any living person, including my boyfriend who lives with me for at least 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was a lot because if there was any comfort in like when I was like, okay, I have to pack and go home, I was like, well, at least I'll see my boyfriend soon. I miss him. And then I was like, no.
Yeah.
No, I won't. So it was hard. It was a rough period of time.
Yeah, especially because it was so much in the beginning. People weren't really wearing anything.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know anything. I must say, wow.
It's really a miracle that I didn't get sick, actually. When I got home that first week, it was very much waiting for the symptoms.
I thought
it was a certainty.
Yeah, because then you, I think everybody felt that in the beginning. You start having, I don't know, you wake up with a little bit of pain in your throat, which is probably normal during normal situations. And you're like, oh my God, that's it. I got it.
Yep.
There was no testing, no nothing at the time. So yeah, wow. That sounds like a proper nightmare.
Yeah, it was a long day.
Once it is possible to travel again, what would you like to visit first?
Yeah, one of my first trips will be to finish my Spain trip.
I was thinking that.
I want to finish it. And then I was thinking that since I'll have more time, I might also add on Morocco when I go back. So the rest of my trip was going to be more of the south of Spain, especially the Alhambra in Granada, because I'm obsessed with palaces and castles and forts of all kinds. I could spend hours in them. So that was like one of my main goals. So definitely there. So I'll probably go from Madrid to southern Spain and then to Morocco.
I think like as a Portuguese, I think you're missing something.
I have been to Portugal. There?
Yeah.
Where have you been? I want to go back, but I have been. I've been to Lisbon with my family in 2013 and we spent some time there and we also visited a nearby like harbor town and we also went to Sintra. And saw all the palaces there, which as you can imagine, I loved. So I need to go back to Portugal, but I have at least been there. I stopped in Lisbon on my way to Spain and I was so happy because they were like, your flight's delayed. And I was mad about that. But then I was like, oh, I can get a Pastel Donata.
Yes.
And like I went like running into the airport and I got like three and ate them for breakfast. I was so happy because like no one in the US knows how to make one properly. So I haven't had one since I left Portugal. Well, and I had like five every day.
I do have a recipe that is very similar to I sometimes like this recipe better than the proper one. So I'll send it your way.
Please, super simple.
Super simple.
I'm absolutely obsessed with them.
But so. I asked that because I've been discovering myself the south of Portugal a little bit in the last years because my parents never traveled, so I never traveled. And the south is just so nice as well. So that's why when you said I'm going to Morocco, I was like, oh, no Algarve, no south of Portugal. But I'm joking, of course.
Of course. But yeah, no, I do plan to go back, but there's just so much to see.
And, of course.
after my Spain-Morocco trip, I do kind of have like it more sort of mapped out for a couple of years, because my goal was to hit all six continents before I'm 30, which has been very messed up by this pandemic.
Well, we lost 2 years, like no offense. I just think like, I don't know, like the age we were before the year of the pandemic should be the age we are.
Because I think so.
These 2 years didn't happen.
Yeah, I completely agree. But as a result, I know my next trips will be Buenos Aires. And I want to go to Patagonia as well in Argentina. I want to go to Australia. And Morocco technically counts as Africa. But I do also really want to go see Victoria Falls. And that's been on my list for a long time. And I want to bungee jump there, because they have like an amazing bridge where you can bungee jump. And bungee jumping is one of the only like crazy extreme sports things I've ever wanted to do at least once. Okay. And so I was like, if I'm going to do it, it would be really cool to do it someplace awesome.
Okay. But so. I got a question. Like, do you like, for example, roller coasters?
I do. And here's what it is with bungee jumping too, is that I can't do extreme things that take a long time. So like I've done rope courses and I hate them because I hate like swaying and like looking down and all these things. But what I do love and have done a lot is zip lining. Okay. And the reason I love zip lining is because like being on a roller coaster, all you really have to do is commit to zip lining and then
hold on tight.
Yeah. And just hold on. then you're in the harness, and then you can even have someone kind of push you off. Like you don't need to do, you know, all you need to do is do the one thing. And that's why I think bungee jumping I can do, is because it's only the one, like all I have to do
is let them
bungee jump me. And like, I don't, it's not like, you know, being like hiking up mountains or like, you know, doing any of the like crazy things where you can see the heights below. None of that. Like I couldn't do any of that, but bungee jumping I can do because it's just one jump. And then I'm like, all I gotta do is do the one.
It's so funny. It's so curious as well, because like the situation where we're talking about anxiety, and I'm usually not an anxious person, but when I think about roller coasters and bungee jumping and basically anything that anything can kill me, but like things that I look at them and I think that could really kill me, I cannot do. It's just no. So it's so curious to kind of see you just being like, no, I would love to do that. And I'll be like, I'd be dead before the jump.
I have noticed like what I was talking about with anxiety before, and this is not true of all anxious people, because I have friends who are horribly anxious of flights and things like that, and of heights and of all these things. But like personally, things that make sense to make me anxious rarely make me anxious. Like when I'm in an airplane, I'm fine. Like I have no anxiety about airplanes because once I'm up there, the thought will enter, the intrusive thought will come up. Like,
really?
What if this plane plummets to the ground? And I'm like, what would we do about that? Like, there's what could I do if this plane was plummeting towards the ground? Like, there's nothing I can do. And
nothing, because I'm terrified of flying.
and so like, I am very good in like actual situations that could kill me in that way. I'm actually very good because I have that, like, there's nothing I could do about that.
Just embrace it.
Yeah. My anxiety tends to attach to things that I could do, should have done.
Yeah.
Like on a personal level, or like, what if you didn't do this? You know, what if you should have done this? And so things like driving and stuff, those can cause me more anxiety because those are based on my actions.
Yeah.
But I think that's the difference, is when it's like an airplane, I'm like, there's nothing I can do about an airplane crashing.
That is
like what? And so like my brain can't even think of things to be anxious about with it, unless it like eventually, every once in a while, I'm like, my brain's like, but what if you died? And like, that'll do it. you know, in the sense of like death always makes me anxious, but like in terms of just the purely like being in an airplane, I'm pretty good with that.
Wow. So I'm so jealous. I wish, because it's like, this is terrible, but I haven't been to Portugal. I usually go every year, but last year, because of the pandemic, I didn't go. But on the other hand, when I realized in the beginning of the year, I don't have to fly this year, I was like, oh, I can be relaxed the whole year because I don't have to go anywhere. But it's so, you know, like traveling by plane, it's, you just get so many places so fast. And I know that I will have to travel to see my parents by plane. So I wish I could think like that. I wish my brain worked like that. So we talked about your day job, the writing, embroidery, and other hobbies. So you are usually quite busy. How do you do it all? Do you have any tips for time management?
I mean, okay, on one hand, the real answer is I don't know. I still don't purely understand how I do it all. Because sometimes people ask me that. I'm like, I do. And part of it is just that my brain doesn't understand what not being productive looks like and that it's okay. So, you know, especially when I left college, academia has such a like 24/7, you could always be doing something. There's always another reading, there's always a paper coming up. So there's always something you should be doing. Mm-hmm. And so when I left college, especially, my anxiety rocketed because my brain was like, you know, you leave work at 5. And my brain was like, okay, but like, what are you supposed to be doing right now? Like, there must be something, you know?
Yeah, of course.
I've gotten better than that. That was a rougher summer to get my brain used to the fact that like we're done part of the day. But on the other hand, some of it was just filling that space with things that felt productive, but weren't work.
Yeah,
like the blog and reading and finally writing and like all these other things. So that's a big part of it, is that my brain doesn't know how to just sit back and do something. I am a multitasker. Like even when we're watching a TV show or a movie, like I find it so hard not to be doing something else as well. I'm so fidgety and I need to do something. That's why embroidery was so great. It gave me something to do without not focusing on like fully on what was happening. But I mean, I do have some tips still, despite all that. despite the fact that I would say to everyone who's like, how do you do it all? I'm like, first of all, are you able to nap? Because I can't, because my brain doesn't let me. But so that sounds nice. Napping is great. So things like that. But I mean, the number one thing I'd say is that it's partially about prioritizing. And that's not to say like, oh, well, just prioritize it better. But like, I think one time I was having a conversation with a coworker who had just finished telling me about how she was going to a workout class every single day after work with her sister and how she was loving it. And then, and she's talked to me before about the amazing meals she cooks all the time. She's Greek and she cooks these amazing meals. And she's incredibly social. And then like 10 minutes later in our conversation, she's like, I don't understand how you find so much time to read. And I was like, well, I don't do any of that. Like I was like, I get to work out like once or twice a week. Yeah. I socialize like once, maybe twice a week with friends, and my meals are very simple. So that's how, like you are working out a lot. You are cooking, like that stuff all takes time. So not to say like, you know, prioritize better, but just also like, the one for tips for time management is like, think about what you are prioritizing and either change it if you want to, or just it'll help your anxiety around not being able to do other things. Like if you're like, why can't I read more? It helps to remind yourself that cooking and working out and seeing your friends are things you are doing and not just like the circumstances of life.
Yeah.
And I think similarly, as contradictory as this will sound, one of my biggest prioritizing self-care tips is to make it a thing on your to-do list. Make it part of your schedule. Make it a part of the plan. Because I think a lot of times when we're like, oh, well, I can't take this time for myself, I'm too busy. If at the beginning of the week, you're like, okay, I'm seeing Maria on Tuesday. I have to work out on Friday. On Thursday, I'll take some time for myself and take like a really nice bath and read a lot. Then it helps because now it's on your schedule and it won't feel like you're skipping other stuff if you plan to do it. So like I'll sometimes put like self-care things or like finish a book or like that kind of stuff on my to-do list for the day if I have a really busy day. And that way you can still cross it off and it doesn't feel like something you can easily skip, mm-hmm. which I think is part of it. And then I guess my two other things are use your built-in time. I think like train, bus, commutes, obviously pandemic it's like been slightly different for a lot of people, but like if you take the train or bus to work every day, like I know people who I would sit and like social media is fine and do everything you want. But like I have friends who would be like, I don't have time to read every day, but like I'd ride the same bus as them and they're like on Instagram. Yeah. And I'm like, well, you could read on the bus. And people have motion sickness and things, but I just mean like try to take advantage of those kind of in between times because they're excuses. No one expects you to get anything done on the bus on the way home. It's like a built-in time of your day where no one expects you to get anything done. It's part of why I love airplanes, because no one expects you to be in contact on airplanes. No one expects you to get work done on airplanes. So you have an excuse for that entire time to do whatever you want. It's like a lawless place. you have permission. And finally, if you're trying to like break habits or reprioritize things with like the self-care stuff, I found that the main thing to do is to focus on positive and not negative reinforcement. Some people it works better the opposite, but I feel like it's easier to abandon goals if every time you do badly, you like put an X down. Yeah. Because then eventually you just get like, oh, well, I'm not doing well. And one of the things I started doing, for example, is I changed it. And instead of saying I have to work out 2 to 3 times a week, I got Girl Scout cookies earlier this year and I put them away on a shelf. After eating like a bunch of them, but I put the rest, I put the other boxes away on a shelf and I put a thing in my journal that was like workout tracker. You get a box when you hit 30 workouts. Mm-hmm. And I put a sticker whenever I do a workout and it's not binding in any way. So like if I skip a week, I'm not like punished. I just know that I'm farther away from the Thin Mints.
Yeah.
And it helps a lot to make that flexibility because it makes it something fun and like you want to put more stickers instead of something that just makes you feel bad because you will abandon that eventually. Yeah.
It's so curious because like they use that a lot, at least in here with kids as well. Like if you do something good, you'll get a sticker. If you eat all your food or whatever. I mean, I know with food it's kind of different because not everybody has the same relationship with food, especially kids. But yeah, if you do this, like if you go to the toilet by yourself, you get a sticker. And I think that works a lot, especially with creating habits. Because I also, like you said, I started doing yoga every day in the morning. And I told myself I want a new mat because I don't have a yoga mat. But I will do 30 days so that I know that it's worth investing on it. And it kind of, now I'm doing it every day because it became a habit. Mm-hmm. So it's super interesting to see how those things works and all those things work. And also doing the self-care within your routine. Like it's as if, this is going to sound bad, but it's as if self-care was part of your job. Like you have this job of self-care and it's in your schedule. That's very clever.
Yeah, it helped. It helped me at least. I feel like for some people, it'll just cause more stress. That's very possible. But I know
maybe for
people who have that same type of anxiety, at least as me, or that same type of stress of like, well, where will I fit in my day? How could I possibly put it, putting it on the to-do list just makes your brain make space for it as something legit for you to do.
And you visualize it, like you look at the calendar, you know that hour is yours and you're free to do whatever, instead of just thinking, oh, do I have time now or should I be doing something?
Yeah, exactly.
So, which happens a lot. So that's very clever. Let's talk about reading because this is a book podcast. And do you want to tell me how and when you became a reader?
Yeah, I mean, I have always been a reader. I come from a family of all readers. You know, one of my aunts used to take me to a used bookstore whenever I visited her. My mom took me to the library every other week because it was like the 2 weeks when your book were due, and I would take out 7 because that was the limit you could take out at the time. Once I had a really, our public library was really tiny at the time. It's now they've renovated it and put it in a new building, which made me cry when I saw it, because our old library used to be in the town hall basement and it was tiny and it would flood at least once a year.
Oh.
And so it was like a lot. And it got to the point where, like, when I was a young adult, my mom found me taking adult books off the shelf and was like, I don't know about this. Why are you reading these? And I was like, oh, it's because, like, I'm out of books from the young adult section. And she was like, okay, we're going to the bookstore. So that's when we started going to the bookstore. But it's just always sort of been there. Like, my grandparents' house, my grandfather and step-grandmother on my mother's side are both professors, and their house always seemed like magical to me when I was little, because it's just books stacked everywhere, bookshelves everywhere, probably very dangerous because they're just packed with books. So it's just always been there. And then from there, like, I was always reading. There was definitely a point in school where they could have cut away at that a little bit, where some teachers tried to make reading really not fun, but which I've written a piece or two about. But I was lucky enough to have some really amazing English teachers, especially in high school, who really encouraged me. And I had one, my sophomore English teacher, who would, like, give me books to read that were like modern authors that I hadn't heard of yet, but that were just like literary fiction at the time. Like, she gave me Haruki Murakami, Nicole Krauss, Jonathan Safran Foer. Like, she was just supplying me with, like, the books of the time, really. And that helped get me into, like, what was, like, sort of going on in the scene too. And so I'd say that's sort of the evolution there.
Yeah, because a lot of kids, I think, they just assume, without having any other opportunity to find reading, they just assume, I don't like reading because the books they give me are not books that I like. And that is so sad.
Or just the process. I wrote a piece about this, but in sixth grade, they had us read The Hobbit because they were like, oh, kids will love it, it's fantasy. And they were probably right, except that we read it in popcorn style in class.
What does that mean?
Popcorn style meant you went around the classroom person by person, and each person read a paragraph.
I didn't know it was called that.
Yeah. And that's how we read The Hobbit.
Wow.
It took us 6 months to read The Hobbit. And we weren't supposed to read ahead. I almost got in trouble twice for reading ahead.
Wow.
Which is infuriating just as a concept, that you'd be mad at a kid for reading faster, whatever. But by the time that class finished, that's why I irrationally hate The Hobbit, which comes up sometimes, because so I just, it's a fantastic book, but I can't look at it because I read it like 5 times at least, just from sheer boredom, as we read the class paragraph by paragraph. But I think it was a great example about, like, how certain ways of teaching reading are just counterproductive. Like, I can't think of anything that made more of a case for why we should hate reading more. It made this fantastic fantasy novel a paragraph by paragraph, like, fight to get through, right? And the whole, like, punishing kids for reading ahead, punishing kids for, like, you know, and, like, it's the first time when I finally hit my first, like, honors English in seventh grade. And the teacher was like, take this book home and read these 2 chapters by yourself. Wow. I was so happy. I was like, finally, I can go home and read something at my own pace, you know? And it was such a relief. And so, to your point, like, I feel like too many kids think they don't like to read because of the way they read in school or the things they read.
Same thing, I think, with physical education. Because it is used as a punishment in the sense, if you don't do that, you'll go and run another lap.
Yeah.
So immediately you're saying this is a bad thing. This is a thing that you shouldn't like doing.
Yep.
So it's very, very sad. Do you have a favorite genre or a genre that you read more?
I'm definitely partial to fantasy. I have been since I was little, and I've always been really into it. And that's expanded, you know, into speculative fiction, you know, genre bending. Sometimes like sci-fi can really be in that same fantasy category in some ways. So now it's more like fantastic fiction, mm-hmm. surrealism, magic realism, all those things. But just that extra touch of wonder and inventiveness really always does it for me in just some like a different way.
On your Instagram account, you have novels in progress in your bio. Are you working on a novel? Anything you can share with us?
Oh, I am. Well, I actually recently finished a novel and have been querying it with agents. Mm-hmm. It's a YA contemporary about that's very much based on my own teens. And it's based on a friend breakup I had in high school.
Oh, that's so nice. I mean, sorry, yeah. It's not nice that you had the breakup. It is just nice that, like, maybe you don't see a lot of books with, you know, friendship as the main theme, but carry on, sorry.
No, totally. That's a lot of why I wanted to write it, is I had been toying with writing, like, a sort of YA contemporary, but I didn't really know how to do it or why I would, you know. And then I read Morgan Parker's Who Put This Song On, and it was more just I think she basically was like, well, this was me in my teens, and I wanted teens like me to learn about me in my teens so that they could, you know, and learn how things could be better. And I think that sort of broke it through for me, like, oh, right, I have a YA contemporary. Like, it's right there. I can write about this friend breakup and all the things that I sort of learned from it, because I think it was a lot about that feeling that I think a lot of teens have about being too much, trying too hard, getting teased for being like an overachiever or trying to go too hard. And by the time I got to college, I was finally realizing, like, what are they talking about? Why is that bad? Like, that's not bad. But it took me a while to really, like, internalize that. And so I wanted to write that novel where the lessons are a little more ingrained in, like, the actual, you know, the actual course of this girl's senior year, mm-hmm. and where she's able to sort of make those realizations. And so there's a friend breakup, but there's also like a best friend in the novel who is really based on my best friend and me. And that close friendship is sort of a foil of like how friendship really should work and how good it is. And so it really is grounded around friendship. And there's also a sort of rowing subplot in there for any crew fans, because I rowed crew in college and soccer was a big part of my high school life, but I really wanted to write about crew because I just think it's such a fantastic sport, especially talking about things like trust and friendship and being in sync with people and like all those kind of things. And so that's sort of a subplot as well.
Great. So you are still querying it. So you don't know exactly dates, anything.
Tragically, no. I hope to be able to update you soon. But for now I am I'm researching for a book that I hope to write that's just supposed to be like, I don't quite have like the world built out yet. I know what I want to happen to the characters. I really want it to be like two older people who have sort of been separated since the apocalypse. It's not the apocalypse, but since like the world like went to shit basically. And they were separated at like a college age, and now they like meet again when they're like 50 and have been established at like different parts in this weird dystopian type world. And I really wanted to get at that sort of like, I think in The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro, he talks about how like the best love story never ends with the two people kissing. It comes after. And I wanted to, that's where this sort of idea first came from, is the idea of telling that story of like how different people will be at that point, especially when they've gone through so much, but also how like two people who understand each other will sort of always understand each other. Mm-hmm. But I really want to build the world, and I really want it to be very like biological and strange. And so I've decided that before I sort of start it, in order to create that surroundingness, I'm just going to read a bunch of books about nature and nature being cool. Mm-hmm. And even if I don't follow half of those like what's actually possible, obviously, because it's going to be like fantasy sci-fi, but I want to like read a bunch of those, and that'll give me ideas for how nature can be crazy in in this world.
Very well. And well, in case, not in case, when you have that out, when can people find it? Where can people find you online?
People can find me at Instagram at While Reading and Walking, Twitter reading_while, and at whilereadingandwalking.com. And I will post any updates there about my writing and also my book reviews and book photos.
Now, this is the last question of every episode, so this episode as well. And I would like to ask you an all-time favorite book and a book you would recommend right now.
An all-time favorite book. It's always hard just to pick just one, but I will. I promise. An all-time favorite book, I'll go with The Waves by Virginia Woolf. I think it's a wild book that really took me by surprise and really made me go from being a Woolf fan to like Woolf obsessed. And she tells a story of a group of friends who have known each other since childhood, but she tells it all in these gorgeous like soliloquies that are very strange and poetic and wonderful, and kind of follows them into adulthood and the ways that they're estranged but still connected, and the ways that they like can't get away from each other and also don't like each other anymore and things like that, you know, the really sort of like the people you grew up with and how that connection is so solid but also like really can fade in a lot of ways. And it's just a really beautiful novel and blew me away in a lot of ways. And one book I would recommend right now, also so many.
You can say more than I know this is a bit unfair, and I've said it for the people.
No,
you can
good.
Say more than one, just like not 20.
Yes, no, you're good. When will this come out? Because I don't want to give one that's not out yet. But
that's okay, because then people can look forward to it.
Okay. Good point. Okay. So one book that I'd really recommend right now is coming out June 22nd. And I'd recommend What You Can See From Here by Mariana Lecky. It's translated by Tess Lewis. I'm just double checking that all that information I just gave you is actually correct.
It will be on the show's notes as well.
Yes, okay, it is. I figured I could say it again if it was totally wrong. But yeah, What You Can See From Here was actually a bestseller in some countries of Europe. And it's coming to English translation, at least in the US, June 22nd. I read it a couple weeks ago and just loved it. It really is a fantastic novel about sort of small town and the people that make it up and the ways that they know each other and the different ways we love each other in a lot of ways. And it's astoundingly funny. And it all starts when the grandmother of our main character, when someone's about to die in town, she dreams of an okapi, this crazy animal. So one day she dreams of one, and everyone in town finds out like immediately because it's a small town. And everyone in town is like, okay, like half of the people in town are like, nothing's gonna happen. It's not connected. And then half of the town is like, should I do something? What if it's me? Like, what if it's, and so there's like one woman who's very superstitious and everyone's coming to her house being like, is there anything superstitious like I can do so that it's not me? Some people are wondering like, should I finally tell that person I love them? Because what if it's me? And the two main characters kind of nervously go to school because like the whole town's in a hubbub, but it follows this main character through like three parts of her life. And all with like the same village characters sort of surrounding her who are funny and weird and like, and you know, there's death and there's like different connections made. And it's just really lovely novel. I really fell in love with it. So I would recommend that one.
Thank you so much, Leah. It was really nice to have you on the podcast.
It was lovely talking to you.
Thank you. You can access today's show's notes via my pod page, which you can find along with all of my social media links at linktree/Karina Pereira. In there, you'll also find a link to a Story of Sorts playlist available on Libre.fm containing the audiobooks recommended by our guests, which will be updated as the show progresses. If you'd like to give Libre.fm a try, you can use the code STORYOFSORTS at checkout to get two books for the price of one. This offer is valid for new Libre.fm members in the US and Canada. Libre.fm is an audiobook platform which allows you to buy audiobooks directly from an indie bookstore. Check them out. If you have enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting A Story of Sorts on Patreon. Patreon is a platform which allows you to contribute monthly to the podcast in exchange for extra content, such as early access to episodes, a shout-out at the end of an episode and on Instagram, and choosing a theme for me to talk about on the podcast. You can become a patron at patreon.com/astoryofsorts. I'd also be very grateful if you would simply leave a review and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. I will be back with a new episode still this week to talk about the books that I've read in April. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss anything. I'll talk to you then, and thank you for listening.